I've been known to, you know, spoiler alert, put on the Astro suit, our mascot at the Challenger Learning yes. Center, and I'm super proud of that. That is one of the you know, probably the most fun part. There's so many great parts of that job.
And with that helmet, there is no way of knowing who's inside there.
That's right. And, right. And the reason we do that, so Astro is really iconic, and there's two things that Astro doesn't do. Astro never lifts the visor, which is completely mirrored, and it's very hard to see out of, which is why you'll usually see Astro with a handler.
Right.
And Astro never speaks. And the reason why we have those two things is so that no matter who is with Astro, boy, girl, black, white, doesn't matter, when they look in that visor, they see themselves.
From Fiori Communications, it's How I Got Here, a show of inspiring stories from Tallahassee area leaders, business owners, and neighbors. All the challenges, opportunities, inspirations, the twists and turns of life that led them to where they are today. Everyone has a story worth telling, and I am really grateful that we get to bring a few of them to you. I truly have been changed by my conversations with these amazing people, and I'm confident you will be too. I'm Dave Fiore, and in this episode, I speak with Alan Hanstein, the Executive Director of the Challenger Learning Center in downtown Tallahassee. Alan grew up in Rockland County, New York, a short drive from Manhattan that provided for fun and relatively safe teenage exploration, at least during the day. His life took a dramatic turn while headed home on winter break from the State University of New York at Fredonia, where he and his friends stopped to help an overturned tractor trailer during a terrible snowstorm. A passing car hit Alan on the side of the road, flipping him into a snowbank, breaking both legs, and changing the trajectory of his life. After a remarkably fast recovery and exploring a few life options, Alan decided to continue his education at Florida State University, where a European trip derailed his education for a bit before he eventually returned to earn his degree. It was during that time that Alan accelerated his career journey by combining his work in the event management industry with his knowledge of innovative technologies that would eventually lead to online event registration. His job would take him around the world, rubbing elbows with celebrities at high-profile events and parties. But his favorite place has always been with his wife, Amy, whom he met as a scuba instructor, and their two children, who are now grown. At the Challenger Learning Center, Alan is living out a dream that includes a lifelong passion for science and space and giving back to the community. His programs serve more than 50,000 K-12 students every year, and they host popular events and activities for kids of all ages. We began our conversation talking about growing up near New York City. All right, so you are from Spring Valley, New York.
I am.
So I looked that up on Google to see where it was. It looks like it's not far from the city, right? It's not way upstate New York or anything.
No, so it's really funny because people in Long Island will say, oh, you're from upstate. And I'm like, I am way closer to Manhattan than you.
Right.
When people ask me about Rockland County, which is where Spring Valley is.
Okay.
We tend to talk about counties also in New York.
More than cities? Okay.
Because there are so many small towns and cities. You know, but if you're from Rockland County, people ask me what that's like, and I say it's just like Tallahassee. I mean, it literally, I grew up in Tallahassee. We had a street called Route 59 that might as well have been Highway 90, right? Had the car dealers on it and the fast food restaurants. And, you know, we had the same types of schools and high schools, you know. We called them junior high schools back then, not middle schools.
So did I.
But the way I explained it is I grew up in Tallahassee, but if you hopped on I-10, instead of getting to Monticello, you'd get to Manhattan. So that's about that same distance. It's actually a little closer for us to get to Manhattan. The funny thing is at, you know, 2 in the morning coming back from Manhattan, it might be 25 minutes. At 8 in the morning going into Manhattan, it might be 3 hours in traffic.
I mean, did you spend a lot of time in the city? Were you a big city kid growing up?
Yeah. I you know, first, my parents did that. My dad obviously worked in the city. He was in the garment district, so we spent a lot of time in the city. But also, my parents recognized that that was, you know, important to go and see the things that, you know, were there that we had access to. So, you know, from that standpoint, just going into the city and walking around and going to shows and going to Rockefeller Center and, you know, just seeing life. But also, you know, I'd go in with my dad a lot, especially when I was a little older. But then also, like, school trips, you went to the city. That was every single school trip. You went to see a Broadway show or a museum.
Yeah.
And that was a lot of fun. And then as I got older, yeah, Friday nights going into the city to see a show, you know, CBGB and Limelight and, you know, seeing acts that, you know, you lose track of now how many opportunities we had. It was fantastic.
Right. And was it, I know it had a reputation of, or it got cleaned up in recent years, but it was a little seedier back then, wasn't it?
Or yes. Not? Yeah. I like to say, like, back when I grew up, you know, in New York, if you went to the Flower District, you know, during the day they would pack flowers, you know, into giant, you know, plastic containers, and they would ship them out over the tri-state area during the day. And if you went there at night, you would get murdered. And then in the meatpacking district, if you went there during the day, you could literally, I mean, you know, we used to walk these neighborhoods, and during the day, they would have slabs of meat out, and they would be cutting meat and putting it on trucks and sending it out. And if you went there at night, you would get murdered. There was no Chelsea. There was no, you know, Times Square was very different. You know,
but meatpacking district, garment district, all those areas, they're iconic. By name, at least.
And they still exist by name, but now they're, you know, gentrified and, you know, $1 million and, you know, walk-up townhomes and all this stuff. And New York is still very much a working city. If you drive down the streets in New York, which I was fortunate in my previous, you know, career, past 2 years ago, to spend a lot of time still in the city.
Right.
And so it was always fun, you know, getting to go back up there. But it's very much a working city. Like, just behind the scenes of all these things in the streets, things are going on all the time to keep that city alive. It is my favorite city. I just don't enjoy living there anymore.
Right.
So, yeah,
how did you take all that in as a kid? That was probably a lot to consume and see.
Especially Times Square.
Yeah.
I think you just absorbed it. It was just normal. You know, you grew up.
And your dad was there with, I mean, you weren't wandering alone, right? Sometimes you were?
You were. Even as a teenager, I mean, I had plenty of opportunities to go in the city by myself. And you didn't think about it then. And that's not just there. I'm sure in Tallahassee, you know, 30, 40 years ago, people were much different with their kids.
Sure. Yeah, we all do that. We all had to be home by dark, but our parents had no idea where we were. But I wasn't in New York City.
Okay, yeah, to be fair. And, you know, my dad was mugged at least once at gunpoint. So, and I think that had a little bit of a profound effect on him. But he just took it in stride.
Yeah,
cool. It's all part of that. And I never, you know, never really had any issues in New York.
Yeah. So tell me a little more about your parents. And do you have siblings? What was your family growing up?
Yeah, I have two siblings. My sister, Alyssa, is still in New York, in Rockland County. I don't think they'll ever leave. She has two sons, my nephews, and then lots of grandbabies. And she actually lives like a block from the junior high school that I went to.
Okay. So,
yeah, and she's 8 years older than I am. And then my sister, Heidi, who is out in Chicago and St. Augustine, ironically, with her partner, she's 4 years older. So that's a pretty big gap.
Yeah.
It is kind of interesting. I would say, you know, as a child in the 80s, you know, my parents were busy and doing things like all the parents. So I feel like, you know, Alyssa, my older sister, was kind of like, you know, mom at home.
Second
when
mom.
We got home. Yeah, yeah. I think that's true and did a lot for us. Heidi and I were a little like oil and water at that point. So, you know, but we're amazingly all close now. My mom moved to Florida and still lives in Delray Beach now, but she moved to Florida actually after I did. So I was the first Hanstein to move to Florida. She moved with her second husband. New York, growing up, parents. Yeah, interestingly enough, so my dad was in the garment district when I was really young, you know, working in New York. All of that business, so this is, you know, very early 70s at this point, all of those mills that produced all of the fabric for the garment district in New York were all in Pennsylvania down to like South Carolina, right? Okay. North Carolina, South Carolina were the big mill states.
Where cotton came from.
Yeah. Right. And I mean, there's like a whole, right? That makes sense. There's that whole, you know, kind of sad history there of why those are located there. And probably no better than why they went overseas where labor was cheap and who knows what's, you know, happening in those
conditions. Yeah.
But sometime in junior high school, all of those mills shut down, right? So this is probably like 1979, 1980. And that all of that business moved east. And so as part of that, so did my dad. And so from junior high school on to high school, he was spending a really large part of his time in South Korea. And so that could be 3 months at a time. And, you know, it is what it is. He did what he needed to do to support the family. And you know, we all appreciated that. I think it was always, you know, fun to, you know, hear from him and talk to him and then, you know, get, you know, probably poorly made sneakers that that he would bring back with all kinds of other, you know, swag. But yeah, so I mean, that obviously I think made me quite a bit more independent than I could have been otherwise.
Yeah, yeah. And your mom worked in event management at one point?
Yeah, so I mean, that's kind of like the segue into my interesting, you know, how I got into
which I'm not going to let you get there yet.
She worked a lot, and that was great to see that she was always working. She for a long time was like worked in, you know, hairdresser shops. She was always the, you know, receptionist and accountant. So she, you know, she had kind of an accounting background.
Okay,
bookkeeper is, I guess, what you would call it back then.
Right.
And so she always, you know, was doing that kind of work. But also she was hugely involved in community service.
Okay.
I can remember being super young and seeing her dressed up as like a clown to go to a facility that we had in Rockland County for folks that were developmentally disabled, probably one of the biggest in the state at the time. And I didn't really know what she was doing at the time, but it made me happy to know that she was making other people happy. And she knows how I feel about that. Like I try to be community oriented. I think in my DNA, just because of everything that she did for so long and seeing that. So proud to say that.
Yeah.
I've been known to, you know, spoiler alert, put on the Astro suit, our mascot at the Challenger Learning Center. And I'm super proud of that. That is one of the you know, probably the most fun part. There's so many great parts of that job.
And with that helmet, there is no way of knowing who's inside there.
That's right. And the reason we do that, so Astro is really iconic, and there's two things that Astro doesn't do. Astro never lifts the visor, which is completely mirrored, and it's very hard to see out of, which is why you'll usually see Astro with a handler.
Right.
And Astro never speaks. And the reason why we have those two things is so that no matter who is with Astro, boy, girl, black, white, doesn't matter. When they look in that visor, they see themselves, and they can think that they are going to be an astronaut. Yeah. And it makes me so happy when people see that. Now, I still am amazed at how many people I was out recently as Astro. And because I can't speak, it makes it hard sometimes to hear this, but I absorb it. And there are a lot of people that still give astronaut a male pronoun. Mm. You know, tell him to come over here. Can we get a picture with him? And I will be happy to say that we have very many awesome women in STEM and astronauts, including the next crew that will go to the moon that includes a woman and a person of color for the first time to step on the moon. So, yeah, I mean, that is tough. You know, that's just
that takes a while. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's something that I can't combat directly as Astro, but that in our messaging from the Challenger Center, at a very young age, we make it clear that everything we do is accessible.
It's for everybody. Everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Stars for all.
Yeah. That's awesome. All right. So you're in New York. You graduate from high school there, right?
Yep.
And then you come to Florida State.
Well,
right. Or is there more to it?
There's a lot more to that.
Okay. That was my question. How did you end up in Tallahassee?
This is the show, right? How I got here.
How you got here.
How
literally did you get to Tallahassee?
Yeah. So I graduated high school, went to Fredonia, which is a small school in upstate New York on Lake Erie. Gorgeous town. I wasn't aware of something called Lake Effect Snows until I went there. It started snowing in October and never stopped. I don't think it's probably still snowing now. I think we had 8 feet of snow. So I'm up in Fredonia. I come home for winter break. When I was in high school, I rode on an ambulance corps. We had a all volunteer ambulance corps in Rockland County. Rode on an ambulance corps. When I was home for winter break, was taking a ski trip with a buddy. We were on the Northway, which is just north of Albany, and we saw an overturned tractor trailer on the other side of the road smoking. We pulled off. We safely crossed the highway in a snowstorm. We got the guy out of the tractor trailer. He was fine. We were three of us standing there, and I had the good fortune to be taken out by a K car. So that dates the accident, you know, January 3rd, 1986. You know?
Yeah. Wow.
So she was going like 60 miles an hour, lost control of her car in the snow and hit me head on.
Wow. This is like a Plymouth or a Dodge
or
something? Like,
yeah, Plymouth Reliant.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep. So I think I still have the star on my knee.
Wow. So it just completely took you out.
Yep. Fortunately that I landed in a snowbank, probably would have killed me otherwise.
Wow.
Woke up in the hospital there in Schenectady and had broken both my legs, tib fib fracture on my left leg. So green stick straight through. I'm always, you know, when I had the good fortune to meet Joe Theismann here at Quarterback Club, and we literally talked about that. And I've, you know,
so had the same kind of surgery he had.
Yeah, same surgery, same break. You know, wheelchair, crutches, cane over the course of about a year. But I had, when I was in the hospital, I had made a commitment that I'd be skiing in a year. I was there for a long time. It felt like a long time.
Yeah.
And you know, while I was in a wheelchair and hadn't been released yet, there was a young boy who was brought in with severe burns. And I was, you know, pretty young, I guess, still at the time. And they were like, hey, can you go just hang out with him, you know, play cards, play whatever. And that experience had a also profound impact on me. I was a month in, I was pretty upset about what had happened to me.
Right.
Like, why did this happen to me? How did this happen to me? I was really obnoxiously selfish about what, you know, oh, you know, I was going to do this and I was going to do that and I can't go back to school and I had this and all that. And that experience really put me in my place.
Yeah.
So I, you know, I appreciated that. And it happened really quickly, like almost instantly, like, oh yeah, duh.
Put your situation in perspective.
100%. Like, I'm gonna walk out of here, you know, someday.
Right.
Like, this kid has a long road ahead that may never be the same. So, and I see that all the time now. And I try to maintain perspective, not just because of that.
Sure.
But that one at the time. So, okay. So I went back to Rockland County. Couldn't go back to Fredonia. Had already missed that, you know, window. Did some community college time trying to figure out where I was going to go. At that point, my dad had actually moved out to California. So, you know, we're like basically now 88, 89, 88.
Okay.
And they had just had the earthquake when I went out there. So went out there, drove down to San Diego, went to every state school, kind of fell in love with UC Santa Barbara. But he had not been there that long and I could not get residency there. And also the schools were really hard to get into, even then, for out of state. So, and then he was already like, he had not been out there that long. And he was already like, I don't, you know, earthquakes, not my
scene. Thing. Yeah.
Not, California's not working out. Had a great trip out there though, and really kind of fell in love with California, which I enjoy going back out to now. Plan B was my grandmother lived in Delray Beach at the time. And I was told that, like, hey, Florida, you know, residency, basically you can just use her address.
Right.
So I applied. Now, the application process was funny, and I can show you, I still have the sheets. So I go to the library. There's two books that, you know, how I got here, I can tell you there's two books. Barron's College Guide, 1988,
right.
And Good's World Atlas, 1980. Okay. Barron's College Guide, I had kind of decided, okay, I'm going to Florida. Wanted to go to a big school now, kind of had kind of that small school experience. Had it narrowed down between UF in Gainesville, and FSU in Tallahassee. I had never been to either city. The only place I'd ever been was, you know, Jacksonville, I-95, driving to Florida. You know, as good New Yorkers, we did that trip every winter to see my grandparents.
Right.
They got here before I did. They were here in the 70s when you could have bought all of Delray Beach for $5.
Right.
I only knew East Coast, you know, beach, Delray Beach, beach. And the Barron's College Guide opens with sitting on your front porch, drinking a beer, smelling sweet magnolias. It's sometimes hard to forget that, you know, FSU is one of the top, you know, universities, you know, public universities. It was it was just really poetic. And then I got out Goods World Atlas because I had never heard of either of these locations. And, you know, Gainesville's over there. It's in the middle of the state. Okay, boring. Tallahassee is over here. It's the state capital. There's a star. Around the star, there's a circle. And the circle in Goods World Atlas 1980 is touching the water. And so I'm thinking, this is Delray Beach. How far could that be, right? Yeah. Like, this is gorgeous. I love that beach. We're going to go, it's like South Beach, you know. Yeah. We're awesome. So I applied, got accepted, sight unseen, drove my Subaru, 84 Subaru GL, down to Delray Beach, stayed with my grandparents, grandma at the time, and then drove up to Tallahassee in the middle of the night, December 1989.
So what did you study?
When I first got here, I was, I'll get them in order. So at Fredonia, I had switched from engineering to philosophy, like my first semester. So that's, we're two down. I got here, I had to declare, I chose meteorology. That didn't work out very quickly. And then I ended up landing in communications. Thankfully, I ended up even before I got here, I was a big Apple guy. You know, back, you know, when the Mac first came out, in 84, before that TRS-80, but was familiar enough with the Macintosh that I was able to kind of wheedle my way in to the, like, really only Mac lab on campus at the time, met two amazing professors, Ed Forrest and Ed Watchering, who were kind of channeling what was the media lab at MIT at the time. They'd both been there. Had created this interactive communication and marketing degree. And so I kind of, you know, hooked my horse to those guys and, you know, never looked back. And it was amazing. So ended up staying in communication and then didn't graduate. So stayed through. We had an opportunity to go to Europe with Philips. So this is lots of technology happening at this time, and there was a technology called CDI that was going to be the next big thing. Heavily invested here in Tallahassee, oddly enough. The guy who—
Jerry Lundquist.
Yep, Jerry, who had Homes and Land, sold that, put a lot of his resources—
Right, instead of CD-ROM.
Correct.
Right? It was the beta VHS situation.
Exactly. And well, CD-ROM was out, and we were using that a lot, and that was kind of the play version.
Okay.
CDI was this technology that incorporated the interactive portion, which was the eye. And those players allowed you, if you remember some of the games like they had in the arcade where you could make decisions, and it would show you video based on those decisions. It was video games and real video. And they had a lot of opportunities. I mean, two things, I think.
I know it was used in training, too. Like, we're going back to the ambulance. Like, you come up to a patient.
Exactly.
They exhibit this. Do you do this?
A or B. A or
right.
B, and then you'd see the video for that. That was the interactive portion.
It's funny how small of town, because I actually was editor of Tallahassee Magazine. At the time, Jerry was investing in CDI and his group of guys that he brought in to work that whole thing. We all worked in the same building.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's right. Yep.
On Centerville.
Yep. So they had arranged for this trip for some of us to go over to Eindhoven, and I kind of planned a big European trip around it. The trip to Eindhoven got canceled, and I just still went to Europe. So I started in England, had a good college friend that went with me, and then I kind of just stuck around. Met a girl in traveling and ended up moving in with her in Munich and lived that whole next year with a couple of visits home in Germany.
So you just didn't come back to school?
I just didn't come back to school. I didn't even come back to the— we had at one point, I had made return tickets, and it was like August 6th, and we were in some island in Greece, and it's like August 1st. And I'm like, I don't think I'm going to make it back.
I got to make a decision here.
I'm like, I don't think I'm going to make it back. And so I didn't. And eventually just kind of was like, okay, I need to go
home. Did you tell anyone or just, you just—
Yeah. You know, but it wasn't like there were no— I mean, it was such a great time.
So different, right?
It was such a great time. Yeah, eventually made it back and kind of dilly-dallied with school, but kind of ended up not finishing there. Started working with a couple of technology companies.
But you basically went back home to New York?
No. Came back to Tallahassee.
Back to Tallahassee.
Yeah, back to Tallahassee. Okay. And then in 1994, when I kind of was running out of opportunities here, my wife and I had been dating I mean, I could back up a little bit. Before that, I had found scuba diving, fell in love with scuba diving, was working at Scuba Discovery on Apalachee Parkway. A great memory just popped up about Amy and I's first kind of date. She worked in the suite next door to Scuba Discovery. That's how we met. She was one of our scuba students. I always say, like, in scuba, that's okay, people. Like, don't, you know, you can date your students. Yeah.
Everybody needs a buddy underwater, right?
That was fantastic experience working at the scuba shop. And then I kind of got a real job working for a technology company here in town, and that kind of split into that. And then I didn't know what I wanted to do. I kind of was at that point a little, okay, what's next? Had applied for some interesting technology jobs even out in California to think, okay, well, maybe that. And Amy and I were pretty serious at the time. So we knew that was probably going to be together, whatever we did. She's born and raised in Tallahassee, but I think, you know, I think we could have ended up anywhere. So in 1994, you know, you mentioned my mom and the event industry. Well before that, my mom had kind of gotten in with a group that was doing trade shows in New York as their accountant and bookkeeper. Started as a small group, and they ended up becoming the largest trade show company in the world, which was really amazing.
The Benheim Group?
Blenheim. Okay. Yeah. So they started as H.A. Bruno with the guy Ralph Iannuzzi, who was the dad, the founder, just brilliantly insightful in that.
Right.
There was a shoe show where everything about shoes was happening in New York. If you were in the shoe business, you were going to New York, and you know, you were buying orders and buying boxes and buying shoes and buying soles. And he had the insight to get into technology in the early 80s and created a show called PC Expo, which very quickly became, you would argue, that the second largest computer show in the country. But my mom went to work there. I, you know, did my summers there. You know, when we moved to the Javits, I was, you know, helping out with that. So I was very familiar with the trade show industry. And then all of the stuff I had done with Ed Forrest and Ed Watchering at FSU in the College of Communication on the Macs with interactive technology and seeing some of the applications that were out there, I had an opportunity to work on a show that they were starting as a spinoff of PC Expo. So in 1993, they decided they were going to do a show called I2, the Interactive Information Expo.
Okay.
And I got kind of tapped for helping with that, salesperson, consultant. I moved to New York to do that, 1994, January 1st, 1994, moved back to New York and was, you know, living with some roommates, living, doing this, working on I2. That happened in June, and it kind of very quickly became apparent that we were ahead of our time and I2 was probably not going to get renewed for the next year. And I was like, well, we have plenty of other stuff. They put me down working on conference stuff to try and improve technology. I've always been kind of a efficiency,
yeah,
you know, looking at how can we improve efficiency and processes with technology. So I was working on the conference stuff, and as part of that, you know, I was not working on this, but I saw what they were doing for conference proceedings. And so in 1994, if you went to a conference like PC Expo or Unix Expo or Networks Expo or Comdex, and you went to the conference portion, which was a big deal. I mean, they would have several thousand people spending several thousand dollars to go to these sessions. And there might be six or eight concurrent sessions on any given track on any given day. And there would be 3 days of conferences and workshops. All of that would be in binders. So that you as a speaker would have to get your Lotus Notes file or PowerPoint probably at the later end of that to the company, and they would print them out. Double-sided, three-hole punch, put in binders, three-ring binders, and all those binders would get put in bags, and they were shipping it. And they were spending about $40 per attendee to do that, and happy to do it because they were paying way more
lots
than that.
Yeah.
But the technology wasn't being used at all, and the people weren't, you know, I would see, you know, bags of binders just being left at the center. So I initially, you know, had this idea, like, why don't we try to do something with technology? It just so happened that at that same show, I got asked to be on a panel with a few other folks to talk about interactive technology. My expertise was HyperCard, which was Apple's, you know, technology. And we had a couple of other folks on that panel. And one of them was a guy who was talking about a new technology that was just coming out in 1994 that would allow you to convert documents to a format that can be used on any computer. His name was Chris Warnock. His dad was John Warnock, who founded Adobe. And Chris was the project manager for Acrobat. Mm. And Chris and I became friends, you know, kind of out of that for this idea, and saw that there was an opportunity here. And that sparked the idea of, could we put these into Acrobat? So I had this idea, brought it to my conference folks, and they said, yeah, you know, do that. So I went to the CEO at the time, who was Ralph's son, Steve Iannuzzi. So the two brothers took over the company, Steve and Ralph Jr., and said, hey, I got this great idea. We could do this. Here's how it would work, you know, I think for this show. And all I want to do is do this from Tallahassee. So I can do it. All the technology's there. I can work remotely, which would have been pretty novel in 1994.
Yeah, very.
And this was a seminal, you know, I always say I'm an accidentalpreneur, I guess. Steve said no. I was a little floored at first. He was like, yeah, no. He's like, but I'll give you a contract for one. Our next show, Networks Expo Boston, 95. And if you do a good job, then we'll give you a year. So yeah, so we did that first one. It was extremely successful. I moved back to Tallahassee, like literally January 1st, 1995. Amy and I bought a house.
And then eventually this all led to online registration.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep. You know, we did CDs. And then, you know, you could picture, you know, sometime around 1997, just the Jerry connection.
Yeah.
That first CD, Networks Expo Boston, 95, the artist who helped me create all the art on that and did a lot of the technology, Mike Houghton.
Still
dear friend who met. And actually,
Mike is a fraternity brother of mine.
And
know Mike forever.
And that first disc was burned on the Kodak DC-510, one of only two CD recorders in town that Jerry had, that Mark Lambertson, who was also there, had gotten. And FM Video had the other one. I don't even know what they're called, but you know, okay. Jan and Phil and all those guys, who were like kind of outposts of that. So
the Learn Something guys.
Learn Something, thank you. Yeah, who also came out of that, a lot of that technology and culture. So yeah, I mean, it took a village. So yeah, 1997, we were still doing CDs, hugely successful, as you mentioned. So yeah, Merlin Mann, who also ended up becoming famous, was our first like web developer. We did online registration, you know, for PC Expo using some software that we had found called Cold Fusion. We did a lot of that. I think we first year we did full registration for PC Expo. We did 1 million registrations. And then, you know, my probably, you know, best friend growing up, still dear friends, he had also spun out into that technology because, of course, my mom also got him a job at Blenheim for summers and stayed working there.
Right.
He had spun out into the other side of the registration technology. So I was always focused on online registration, and we were kind of vendor agnostic. He did the on-site registration. So they would like literally go on-site with computers and print badges for that and do all that. And so we ended up merging, being acquired by them in like 2005. And I ended up just staying on with that and developing a bunch of new technology that we did for that. We pioneered a lot of amazing technology over the next, you know, 5 to 10 years, like on-demand printing and scan and print and all of these amazing things that are ubiquitous today in that, but that we were really on the forefront and just fun stuff. I had a unique opportunity in there to have a lot of niche clients.
So this is events registration.
Events registration.
Right.
So Paragon, which—
Your company.
Which was the company that I started when I came back here, which was started literally with my good friend Chris Corum.
I mean, I think a lot of people who've known you for a while, known you as the jet setter event guy who's always rubbing elbows with celebrities, famous people, sports icons.
Yeah, that's the events effect.
So tell us about that. I mean, that seems like just the coolest job ever.
It was fun. Yeah, I mean, no doubt. I will say the coolest job ever is being the executive director.
I'm sure that.
At the Challenger Learning Center of Tallahassee.
Okay, well, pre-Challenger.
Pre-Challenger, that was a fun job. You know, I did travel a lot. The good thing was that travel wasn't like, you know, for months at a time. And trade shows and conferences and events are usually either midweek or only on the weekend. And so I was home a lot. And when I was home, I was home. So
You were sensitive about that because of your dad, right?
I don't think I was overtly sensitive, but I think I became sensitive. And probably now even look back and go like, man, I still probably spent more time away than I could have. But again, it's the realities of that was the job I had, and it was a great job.
And we'll be right back. How I Got Here is sponsored by Barano Heating and Air Conditioning in Tallahassee. I've been friends with Patrick Barano since we met in a Chamber Leads group about 15 years ago. I'll admit that I pursued him pretty hard to be his marketing firm and eventually won him over. And the reason I wanted to work with him is that I was already a customer, and I knew what kind of company he and his father before him had built. He cares about his customers, he cares about his team, and he cares about this community. I've experienced Barano Heating and Air when they installed a complete system replacement a few years ago, and I enjoy peace of mind and same-day service with my Total Comfort Service Agreement. I've also been behind the scenes at their office and seen firsthand the true character of this company. And that's why we're so proud to represent them. To learn more or to schedule an appointment online anytime, visit baranoac.com. They really always will be there for you. And now back to the show. So what was the job? What were you doing when you were going all over the place?
You know, a lot of it was I was just there to be there. So, you know, the technology is pretty good. So, you know, a Google event, for example, we would go and we would set up our technology. And there's a lot of it's just advanced. So, like, most of the stuff we did was online in advance and then on site. So a typical Google event, like for the 2008 inaugural party that was the who's who of everybody, was, you know, a lot of data back and forth, vetting names, making sure we had them in our system, sending out, we had a proprietary like invite system that was secure that couldn't be like, you couldn't share that. And so they would say they were coming and then, you know,
When you say Google event, you mean a party Google is throwing?
Correct. Okay. Yeah. So Google, mostly the DC office, although we did a ton of other ones, Google put on a lot of events, right? Like they had an entire legislative component that liked to do events that they would invite, you know, A-list stars and legislators and investors and all the folks that were, you know, everybody. I'm probably still not. I'm sure my Google non-disclosure was stronger than anything else. But
yeah, we don't need details. That's
we
okay.
did. So we would do all that online stuff. Then we would show up on site. So I'd fly in, and you know, Jeff a lot of times for those events would be with me, and we would set up our technology. And if the event was, you know, the event might only be a few hours, so we would get everything set up. You know, and you know, maybe the night before, you know, we're big StubHub fans, so we would go, hey, you know, Caps are in town. Let's go see a Caps game. This is going on. So never missed an opportunity to have a great meal or do a fun event while we were in a city.
All right, we're going to get you from where we've talked about to the Challenger Center here. So
yeah, that's a pretty quick trip, right? Because I basically did the same thing then for, you know, just same thing. All right, went to events, came home. I think in 2018, I did 6 weeks in Vegas. It was like that was the last big season of like lots of trade shows in Vegas, but in LA and New York. And so that was my last big travel year. So had an opportunity to work with some amazing colleagues here in town. They had a innovative product in the event space that was local, and that was really intriguing to me. And also something that I had never done. So it was an app. I had always eschewed apps on the event side. We never got into the app space. I always outsource that because they're really hard to do. I learned even how much harder to do, and for a variety of reasons. And this was really a unique opportunity to come into a leadership position and work with this team, Dustin Rivest and Jim Hunt, who had a couple of companies, but Event Owl was a product they started. And it was really novel in that it was centered around gamification. So like I thought that was really unique, trying to figure out how we could bring it into, you know, because in the original, in like early 2020, January of 2020, it's still an app for live events, right? Like you're going to go to the show and you're going to have an app and you're going to check in at exhibitors and okay, we'll see if we can sell this, how it would work. You know, March 13th, 2020, and I'm in the event business. And again, you know, perspective, everybody I know growing up, working my entire career in New York, they're all in the live event business. They are literally shuttered. The Javits Convention Center, where I probably have spent, you know, more than a year of contiguous days and nights in, was turned into an emergency hospital.
Right. It was the epicenter on the East Coast, at least, of the whole
pandemic.
That was,
you know, for the second time, you know, after the attacks on the World Trade Center, the Javits got taken over as an emergency operations center. It was so hard to see it being used for that, and now for it being used for this and almost as a morgue in some cases, was really tough, but also tough to think about all my colleagues who were basically out of work. You know, And it wasn't just unique to us, the movies industry and the theater industry.
Right, right.
So many other industries. So we were like, okay, I don't know what to do. We're figuring it out. One of our clients, FASA, Florida Association of School Administrators, Michelle White, who is just an amazing association director, their event was coming up pretty soon. And she was like, hey, what can we do? We've already paid you for this app. What can we do? And they were in, you know, we had a couple of weird, you know, coincidentally interesting clients who were, you know, unusually adversely affected. So school administrators, Florida Healthcare Association, Emmett Reed.
Right.
Like these were people who their, you know, these conferences that they were going to have normally are like, hey, it's a fun meet and greet. You know, the exhibitors want to give you a swag and we're going to take you out to dinner, have all of a sudden turned into life or death, literally decisions that they need to get education out, you know, for FHCA or for how to teach them. What are we going to do? And so we committed over the next 30 days to give them a solution. And my development team was fantastic. Leadership was fantastic. And thankfully, everything we had done to create a web backend basically gave us a virtual event platform that literally we could deploy almost instantly. We were able to thankfully integrate Zoom right into that. Yeah, so we grew revenue 800% through the pandemic. Yeah. But yeah, no. So and then, you know, are we ready for Challenger?
Yes, we can jump into Challenger. So you leave Event Owl. I want to have a transition time there because I do want to talk about, it's not like you went into the Challenger Center out of nowhere. You've been serving on the board forever.
Yeah.
You've been a fan. You've been committed to it. So how did all that play into eventually moving into this position?
Yeah. I mean, I was on the board for 18 years. I still have the letter from Marjorie Turnbull inviting me, which is really special. And we are still dear friends.
Yeah.
But, you know, when the Challenger Center started, there was an initial kind of group, and then they had a board that was this kind of stand-up board. And I had known, you know, I was there at the groundbreaking only because I heard about this thing, and I've always been, you know, passionate about space and science and education. And so Winston Scott, who was at the time the associate vice president of FSU, you know, you kind of forced an introduction, like, hey, I'd really like to get involved with this thing. And Terry Fregley, who sadly, you know, was killed in a plane accident several years after I came on the board, but was a dear friend. Terry was a fellow pilot, and I knew him from AirFest and events we did. And so there was a lot going on kind of at the same time that I knew about Challenger. I went to the grand opening party, and then I was like, I'd really love to participate. And so kind of just kind of wheedled my way on to the board with a, you know, an ask with Winston and Marjorie and Dr. Thagard. It was an incredible board, is an incredible board now. We had incredible leadership. We had a director, Rick Fisher, when we first came on. I really didn't know Rick that well, you know, but we also had a marketing director at the time, Michelle Personette, who obviously was amazing and passionate about the center. So much so that when Rick left, Dr. Thagard was like, yes, you know, Michelle, you know, will be the new director. And she, her tenure was, you know, absolutely stellar.
So before we get into your job and all that, I do just want to just real briefly talk about the fact that it is, you know, an outreach of the FAMU FSU College of Engineering.
Yeah.
Kind of explain that and how we ended up with a Challenger Center here in Tallahassee.
Yeah. I mean, the stars aligned. Is that like too funny?
That's appropriate.
So, you know, if you go all the way back, 1986, you know, the Challenger tragedy, you know, I'm always loath to call it an accident, and sometimes I slip. It's hard to call it an accident when we know what we know now, that it could have been prevented. And that's actually a lesson that we still impart, even with our students that come in, about how engineering is important. And I do a kind of lessons from space little talk, and I talk a lot about in organizations, you know, giving a voice to people, you know, and that's the sadly the ultimate example of how a single voice would have, you know, saved seven lives. So, you know, January 28th, 1986, for those of us, you know, it's one of those seminal moments that we talk about, like
I was in college, I remember.
Yeah, exactly. You know, people remember where they were when they heard about it. And after that accident, the surviving family members, you know, President Reagan, you know, after his speech, a moving speech that night to the American people, I think the idea was that there would be a memorial. and the families were very much adamant that it would be a living memorial. And so working with some folks kind of following along Krista McAuliffe's role in that mission as the first teacher in space, and this idea that that would be the, you know, the candle that we would keep a lit, they created this Challenger Learning Center. I didn't know till recently that initially it was supposed to be a single center, like, you know, in Washington, D.C. Mm. The original vision was like it would be part of the Smithsonian Air and Space, I guess. And for lack of direct funding and some other stuff, they decided a distributed model. So now you get these Challenger Learning Centers that are across the country. So if you come to the Challenger Learning Center, obviously we have an IMAX, mentioned that. We have a planetarium, which is amazing. But we also have what makes us a Challenger Center, which is a mock-up of Houston Mission Control downstairs. It's amazing. And then a mock-up of the International Space Station right above it. So those two rooms are what comprise most Challenger Centers. And those that only had that, I think, especially the ones that were started 20 years ago that are now facing technology upgrades like we just went through, are having trouble sustaining, especially through COVID. You know, it's, I sometimes say for a lot of these, and it's not just Challenger Centers, it's you know, YMCAs and Boys and Girls Clubs. Sometimes it's easier to get the $3 million than to get the sustaining revenue every year, because right. the $3 million is sexy. You can get an appropriation or an earmark or, you know, a matching grant or something to get yeah. that. But getting sustainable annual funding is work, you know, and we're fortunate enough that, you know, again, thanks to the 20 years of legacy that I got handed, we have an amazing reputation and I'm able to do things like get large grants and right. donations and fundraising.
Yeah. So you've upgraded the planetarium. Let's talk about that.
So our planetarium was a Digistar 3 planetarium. It's a company called Evans and Sutherland. They're the recognized leader in planetarium technology and was 20 years old. It had been upgraded, like a partial upgrade once in there. The projectors were probably about that old. We had 6 1,000 lumen projectors that made up the image on the dome. It was not high def by any means, and it ran on Windows XP. It was literally end of life.
Right.
And so thankfully, we were able to get a large grant from the CRA, and that funding allowed us to invest $750,000 so far in that planetarium. So what that got us was a brand new Digistar 7 system, which is incredible. It's state of the art. We used it for the eclipse on Monday to show just all kinds of animations and live feeds. We were able to leverage that, and we just got another very large foundational grant to redo the seats in the planetarium, to add some new technology in there for our lighting, and also allow us to purchase a portable planetarium dome.
Your excitement and passion about this is very obvious. What is your favorite part of this job? What do you love the most about working there?
The people. Yeah. I mean, our team is amazing. So, I mean, that side of the people, that our kids that we get every day, I make it a point to go down when we have field trips. And we serve about 50,000 K-12 students every year mm-hmm. from 68 counties across Florida, Georgia, and Alabama. And so these are kids coming from all different places, right? They're coming from rural counties in, you know, Northwest Florida. They've never seen an IMAX before. They've never been in a planetarium before. And even the ones who've been there and experienced this, doing the hands-on activities that we have, it's amazing. And then I think what I've, especially lately, making sure that we have accessible content. So, you know, folks that normally, we've had a group of adult, mostly with lots of different abilities and developmental disabilities, also physical disabilities of all kinds, but lots of abilities that we've been able to bring in for planetarium shows and other activities. And just knowing that that's something that they wouldn't get to experience. Just at the eclipse, when we had our folks from FAST, Florida Association of Assistive Technology, or no, the assistive technology folks, out with activities, and knowing that we have folks that are blind that can still experience this amazing thing that everybody around them is right. experiencing. We just hosted the Blind Can Film Festival and the Blind Canvas Project, and having those as part of that, and I would never have even thought about this, but they asked, hey, can we, you know, we heard you play video games on the IMAX. Can we do that? And I was like, yeah, okay, this is an interesting request. So we did it. We had Super Mario on Switch on the IMAX. And what I didn't realize was A mom told me that it was the first time her son had been able to play a video game. He's low visibility, but at that size and that brightness, he was actually able to play Super Mario Kart.
Wow.
And so, I mean, those are, you know, everything.
That's incredible.
Yeah. And I mean, it never, 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 ever, ever gets old.
Want to hit on a couple more things real quickly before I let you go. One is we talked about Amy and meeting her and your wife, and just want to talk. I want you to tell us more about her. I mean, we talked about how you met, how she was a scuba student, but that's okay to date your scuba students.
Yeah, in
the
and
scuba
I mean,
world.
You know, and actually, I think the only reason she decided to get certified was like one of the other coworkers there, who one of my other coworkers was kind of liking, you know, decided to do it. And so
she didn't want to go by herself, so she dragged Amy along, maybe.
And I think she wanted to do it. I think that was like, you know, maybe I pressure. I don't think it was me.
But tell us about her and her role in this whole adventure with you.
She is my rock. I always joke that, you know, she's the CEO, the CFO, you know, I'm just the marketing director, like of Team Hanstein. She is an amazing mom and wife who we've been married 28 years, April 20th, 1996, and a fairy tale wedding at Disney. And we always say that will be our fairy tale. But she, you know, born and raised in Tallahassee, but, you know, has followed me on all my adventures and helped me make a bunch of my own, and just is literally my rock and the kids rock. Can't say enough. I guess I can because I did. But love her. Love you.
And then Hunter and Hannah, your kids, how are you transitioning now as they're going and starting their own lives?
Well, we're empty nesters. We've been empty nesters for almost 2 years now, which has been fantastic. We always joke every night is date night. I think, you know, sadly, Amy, you know, a lot of times, like, I would still go do stuff like, oh, I'm going to go to baseball tonight. And she'd be like, well, I'm just going to stay with the kids. And now that she has no excuses, I've been dragging her to everything, every party, every event. And she has been a trooper and kept up with everything to the point now where I think people are like starting to see her sometimes more than me. Hunter is just finishing up his first year of PA school up in Nashville. So that's been tough having him away longer than even when he was away at college. But we talk to him literally almost every day, and we'll see him. And our daughter, Hannah, who does live here in town, is a tattoo artist at Euphoria and has been an artist for as long as I can remember. She's super creative, and I'm absolutely thrilled that she has found something that is an avocation for her that can let her do what she loves doing.
It's very cool.
And she's amazingly talented. It's really cool just for both of them. But like when I see her work on Instagram right now, and somebody will just like literally hundreds of comments about how, you know, the person who got it, how happy they were, which is always like, oh, okay, I guess that's a good thing. but just everybody else in her peer group that is amazed at what she's doing. And I can't, you know, obviously a shout out to Euphoria and Alan Rogers for, you know, giving her that opportunity there. Cause I don't, you know, when you talk about tattoos in Florida, I think, you know, people say, oh, Euphoria in Tallahassee. So it's a big deal for her to be at that level already in her career. But yeah, she's super fun. And but every night is date night now. So
that's
last night we were out way too late.
I do want to touch on another important part of your life is being active and being involved with F3 and rucking and that whole area. So how did you get into that, and explain how that fits into your busy schedule?
Yeah. So it is, I guess, the Tom Dzierzapolski. I mean, I kind of knew about F3 a little bit, and I knew about rucking because I knew about we had had a couple of Go Ruck events, which are these overnight, you know, which I used to think was impossible. You know, somebody would tell you, yeah, we're going to meet at 9 o'clock at night, and we're going to carry like, you know, a 500-pound telephone pole around town and do all this other stuff, and we're going to go for 12 hours straight. And I was like, no, I'll never do that. And now I've done like a bunch of them, you know.
Right.
The most important to me was the 20th anniversary Go Ruck Tough in New York City. We rucked the entire length of New York down to Ground Zero with guys who were there. And it was just finished on September 11th, 2021. And it was meaningful to me as a New Yorker. Having lost friends in the towers, you know, high school students, husbands or friends, really was impactful. But yeah, so Tom Dersipolsky, F3 Minnow, invited me out and I decided to go out. So I went out and that first day it was at the Meadows, which is a park in town. And after a bit of running, they told us to grab some sandbags and we were going to a hill and while pair up and while one guy was doing exercises, push-ups, the other one was carrying the sandbags up and down. Now, I'd already had a sore shoulder, and I grabbed these sandbags, and they had been sitting under a tree outside, and they probably weighed about 60 pounds each. And after that first F3 workout, which was awesome, I found out that I had torn my rotator cuff severely. So tried to rehab that, didn't rehab it, finally had surgery on it, finally recovered. And after I recovered, Tim Templeton, F3 Little Debbie, who had been active in F3 already for the folks that started at Leon High School, had finally moved into Southwood where we've lived for 23 years. I've been trying to get him out there. Finally moved into Southwood and said, hey, I'm going to start an AO, a location here at Southwood. Would you join us for the first one?
Mm-hmm.
And so I came out for that one and, you know, our local F3. So F3 is this national movement. Tens of thousands of guys do it all around the world now. And most of the time you get named after your first workout. We have it a little different. You get named after your third workout. And Tim Little Debbie, he got his name because his first workout, he didn't show up for. It was during Tropical Storm Debbie. He no-showed and said, oh, I didn't think we worked out during the storm. And, you know, one of the first rules of F3 is, you know, outdoors, rain or shine. And so he got Little Debbie as his name. I got a kind one.
I thought he ate a lot of snack cakes.
He does bring them to his birthday workouts.
Okay.
I got a kind one. I got Visa, which right. was awesome, which is, you know, his as he says, it's, you know, everywhere you want to be, which isn't probably as true, you know, anymore, although,
sure.
you know, it sticks with you. But yeah, it's a fun one. F3 is amazing. Really, F3 and Rucking, both life changers for me.
Shout F3 shout out to my son-in-law, Baby Shark. Just didn't want to leave before I said
I don't know that I knew that.
Yep.
Jack Clavenna?
Yes, married to my daughter, Lydia.
Shark. Yes.
All right, final two questions. Alan, looking back, what is the one thing or person that has changed the trajectory of your life to this point?
Yeah, Amy. Yeah, no doubt. My big joke is, you know, there's a song, you know, God bless the broken road that led me straight to you. I always joke, you know, God bless the broken legs that led me straight to you. Cause I mean, there's a long time before I got to Amy, but you know, had that accident not happened, I go back to Fredonia. So I don't go back to Fredonia. I don't do this. I don't do that. I don't come to Florida. I don't find my way. You know, I don't meet her at the scuba shop and, you know, I don't have these two wonderful children. We don't have this amazing life. I don't get to do what I do. There's like, yeah. I mean, there's other folks involved in there, people that have been mentors and influencers. Sure. But no, 100%. She is like the reason I am here. Not to mention, I do dumb things. And probably she's at least talked me out of at least two of those. I have a new saying. It's like, hey, I take calculated risks and I'm not very good at math. So that's my, so fortunately she is much more even tempered.
That's awesome. All right. Final question. The podcast is named How I Got Here. We've talked about how you got to this point in your life. Where do you think here might be for you in 3 to 5 years from now?
3 to 5 years, I hope I am still doing exactly what I'm doing and that the center is thriving. I mean, you know, I don't know how many years I've got to it. Michelle was there almost 20 years. I probably don't have 20. I'd like to think I have 10. I'd like to think they'll have me for 10. We're doing great now. Lots of new outreach initiatives, lots of new creative programming that we've got. So in 3 to 5 years, I hope I am exactly where I am. I hope we have more reach into more communities in not just our area, but across, you know, our region, and that we have an opportunity to bring more students to the Challenger Learning Center. But for me, same office, same Astro suit, right where I am, 3 to 5 years, absolutely.
Thanks for listening to the show. You can subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, please leave us a review.
It really does make a difference. Thanks to my amazing staff at Fiori Communications, who pick up the slack while I'm working on these podcasts, and to Troy Bloom for composing our theme music. You can hear more of Troy's creations on Facebook and Instagram at Troy Bloom Music. To connect with the podcast or suggest a future guest, follow us on social media or email us at podcast@fioricommunications.com.